$1 million for punitive damages, with the fine totaling around $313 million. The court cited statements by high-ranking U.S. officials about the country playing the main role in organizing and directing terrorist groups, particularly the role of the CIA in creating terrorist groups including Daesh.
We unleashed fury all over the Middle East, and it was a terrible mistake. And then Obama came in, and normally you want to clean up. He made a bigger mess out of it. He made such a mess. And then you had Hillary with Libya. So sad. In fact, in many respects, you know, they honor President Obama. ISIS is honoring President Obama. He is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS, okay? He's the founder. He founded ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton. Co-founder, crooked Hillary Clinton.
On June 7, 2017, Iran's parliament and the Imam Khomeini Mausoleum in the capital, Tehran, came under terrorist attacks. Four gunmen disguised as women entered parliament and opened fire on security guards there. And separately, gunmen attacked the Imam Khomeini Mausoleum, opening fire on the people inside the compound. At least 17 people were killed and nearly 50 were injured in these attacks, which were later claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. The Wednesday ruling is based on complaints filed by families of three people killed and six wounded in those attacks. This comes as a number of U.S. court verdicts over years have ordered compensation to be paid from seized Iranian assets to victims of various incidents worldwide, including the September 11 attacks. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
The EU's industry and economy was built thanks to decades of cheap gas supply from Russia. Now the bloc has shut that supply off due to the war in Ukraine. A mild winter ensured reasonable energy storage was maintained in the EU, and prices, while very high, did not bring the bloc to breaking point. The US has made a fortune by exporting LNG, liquefied natural gas, to the 27-nation bloc. Lawmakers warn there could be greater competition for LNG in 2023.
If China were to return to 2021 LNG consumption levels, the EU could end up with a gap between demand and supply of 27 billion cubic meters, which is no small amount. Citizens need to be reassured. We can't just pray for another mild winter.
There have been calls during a European Parliament debate for the EU to urgently up its game regarding energy storage technology.
The EU has only a limited amount of storage capacity, with the majority of energy being stored in the form of pumped hydro, which has significant geographical limitations.
Experts warn that energy shortages in the coming months could push EU inflation through the roof. The bloc's leaders are looking towards Africa and the Middle East for supply, but that's a costly exercise.
The problem is that European leadership is not leading Europe to a better future. The problem is that they are servants of American lobby and they're providing exclusively the interests of Americans.
Iran could solve the EU's energy needs, but the bloc is following the United States down the path of sanctions. Legislators are also critical of moves being made domestically.
Germany has just closed its last nuclear reactor. That is a catastrophe. Germany is risking increasing prices. It's a huge mistake.
Given the dire implications associated with a potential energy crisis, many lawmakers here are calling on those who shape EU foreign policy to put the interests of citizens ahead of demands emanating from Washington. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A new report on global military spending found that the European Union's expenditures soared 13% last year to reach $345 billion. That means the bloc is the world's second largest arms purchaser, sprinting far ahead of China, but spending well less than half of the United States. European military spending has now reached its highest level since the end of the Cold War 30 years ago. The historic increase in European military spending comes despite once-in-a-generation inflation records, as their sanctions campaign against Russia keeps backfiring against the Western economy. Brussels has repeatedly ramped up the conflict in Ukraine with once-unthinkable arms deliveries. European arms are already all over Africa and the Middle East due to Western support for failed interventions in places like Libya, Syria, across the Sahel, and elsewhere.
Europe must prioritize a diplomatic solution in Ukraine. The danger is that when there are guns on the ground, one day somebody might use them. The only way this ends is with the destruction of either Ukraine or Russia, or with people finally getting around a table and working through issues diplomatically.
Last year, Finland, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia recorded the biggest increases in military spending. Globally, defense expenditures increased 4% this year to a record $2.24 trillion. That only barely exceeds the $1.98 trillion budgeted this year for the United States Department of Defense. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Professor David Miller, producer and co-host of Palestine Declassified on Press TV, is continuing his fight against his dismissal from Bristol University in October 2021 for what they called, amongst other things, not meeting the standards of behavior we expect from our staff. The tribunal hearing is set for October 16 this year and is expected to last 2 weeks.
It's a long case by tribunal standards, because there's a huge amount of documentation going along with the case, and that's where we will find whether the university has wrongfully dismissed me, and also whether the court will determine that I was discriminated against on grounds of my political beliefs, which is the claim that we're making.
For Professor Miller, the pressure to remain silent has been unrelenting, increasing in ferocity over the course of the past 3 years.
I'm regularly attacked. I've been deplatformed. I've stopped from having meetings. The police have closed down meetings. We've had to have the meetings outside, all because there have been complaints by Zionists.
Professor Miller is amongst a group of high-profile British figures on the left who have been hounded on charges of so-called anti-Semitism.
The witch hunt against the Labour left, which happened under the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, people thought that had gone once Jeremy Corbyn was gone, but it hasn't gone. We've seen only in the last couple of days the attacks on Diane Abbott, the longest standing black female MP in the country, who has of course faced the most outrageous racism over her entire career, and she has now been jettisoned from the party. Now this is an ongoing process, and they will not stop until they have got everyone out of the Labour Party, and indeed every other part of public life who is able to or willing to stand up to the Zionists to support the rights of the Palestinians.
Professor Miller's advocacy work and contributions to show like Palestine Declassified continues to make him a target for those who would prefer that Professor Miller and those with his way of thinking remain silent. Supporters are being asked to back a special crowdfunding campaign that could help change legal history in the UK when it comes to pro-Palestinian voices.
I will be able to establish, if I win, the principle that you cannot just sack people for being anti-Zionists because the Zionist movement wants you to. And that's never been established so far in law and at industrial tribunal. So that's a key question which I hope to establish. And that's why I'm asking people to support my crowdfunder. I've got to employ lawyers to defend me so we can establish, hopefully, the legal principle that anti-Zionism is protected under equality legislation.
Pro-Palestinian supporters await the outcome of this case with bated breath. Amina Taylor, London.
Iran's Minister of Roads and Urban Development arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking economic delegation. He met with Syria's Minister of Economy and discussed economic cooperation, in which the two sides set new work mechanisms in the financial and economic fields. They underlined the necessity of removing obstacles for better economic and trade relations.
Our meetings today discussed mutual proposals in all sectors to increase economic cooperation. This is the largest Iranian economic delegation visiting Syria. We had constructive talks. we agreed on a new work mechanism and set a new timetable to avoid any delay in implementing projects.
The Joint Syrian-Iranian Economic Committee also convened. The talks covered boosting collaboration in the economic, investment, agricultural, industrial, trade, transport, and religious tourism sectors. The members underlined the importance of canceling custom tariffs and taxes, as well as expanding activities in the banking sector by using local currencies to counter Western sanctions imposed on both states.
We agreed on focusing cooperation in the electricity sector. Syrians are in dire need of electricity due to power shortages. We have lots of experience and capabilities in establishing and repairing damaged electricity stations. We will assist Syria soon in generating electric power. Meanwhile, we agreed on increasing flights to Syria to 50,000 Iranian visitors annually. We also want to establish a direct railway route from Iran to Syria.
A Syrian-Iranian work forum was also held. The officials met with businessmen in the private sector and listened to their concerns. They promised to facilitate their work with the aim of encouraging joint partnerships and increasing the bulk of trade exchange between Syria and Iran. At post-war times, countries like Syria suffer from economic hardships. Iran, as a longtime ally of Syria, is assisting the Arab country to emerge from its economic woes and overcome Western sanctions through establishing partnerships that benefit both countries. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The UK government has come under fire over accusations they have abandoned UK nationals amid rising violence in Sudan. It's believed close to 4,000 British passport holders remain stranded in the Muslim-majority country. British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly was forced to admit that Britain's ability to help remains severely limited unless a ceasefire is reached.
We will continue on our diplomatic effort to bring this conflict to a swift conclusion, because until that happens, we are severely limited in our ability to provide assistance to British nationals.
Criticism of the UK government's handling of the crisis has risen sharply following the news of a special nighttime military operation that was conducted in order to secure the safe evacuation of British diplomats and their families on April the 23rd. However, some have even gone as far as to suggest that the treatment of the remaining stranded nationals may have been very different if their country of origin had been, say, somewhere on the European continent rather than the Muslim-majority African country.
Press TV managed to speak with Ahmed Caballo, a British Sudanese journalist with family now living in a war zone.
A ceasefire. Britain has now announced that it will be trying to evacuate those with British passports. But the announcement came too late, and I feel like they've been shamed into this decision by their European counterparts, who acted decisively and quickly and showed that Britain doesn't care about their citizens, especially if they're of the Sudanese descent. Khartoum, Bahri and Omdurman, which is essentially the capitals of Sudan, have never seen violence like this. So many of these people are completely unprepared for the level of violence that they've seen. I had my cousin's house that had been shelled, which prompted him to leave. There's bullets found in the walls, through the window. All of my family have evacuated to different parts of Sudan. Unfortunately, my dad has decided to stay put, despite our best efforts to convince him to leave. So every single day, you know, my mom, myself, my sister, my niece, whenever we answer the phone, we dread what the news might be.
UK troops have been flown into Sudan, awaiting a chance to begin evacuations. Rival military factions agreed to a 72-hour ceasefire from Monday night in the country, where at least 400 people have been killed in fighting since the 15th of April. So far, 2,000 nationals have reached out for help, but thousands more have yet to do so. The shutdown of the embassy, poor communication, and regular failed ceasefire attempts are contributing towards the crisis, suggesting few lessons have been learned after a similarly scandalous exit from Afghanistan. Robert Carter, London.
The International Organization for Migration, a UN body, says more than 20,000 refugees have drowned in the central Mediterranean since 2014 whilst trying to reach the EU. This year, in January, February and March, 441 have perished.
We currently let people die in the Mediterranean. We let them die by ordering container ships and fisher boats to stand by and wait. We let them die by criminalizing and jailing those who want to pull them out of the water.
The EU's asylum policy has been slated during a debate in the European Parliament.
The UN recently concluded that the Libyan Coast Guard, which is heavily funded by the EU, is deeply involved in slavery, sexual exploitation, human trafficking, detention, and torture of migrants.
The EU is paying billions of euro to Turkey and Libya to manage refugee flows. Campaigners say detention centres in Libya are particularly bad.
The conditions there are horrible. They are defined as hell. We have witnesses of people who were able to escape that, and the stories are just horrible, really. And slavery, raped, forced labor, I cannot just go on.
Western powers have been accused of relentlessly causing refugee crises. They're now being urged to deal with the root causes.
Basically, that means ending wars and interference. It means ending neocolonial policies and plundering. It means ensuring that states are independent. It means we support less developed countries.
The Italian government has declared a state of emergency because 31,000 refugees have arrived into the country since January. During the debate, the point was made that 1 million Ukrainian refugees have arrived into another EU nation, Poland, with no state of emergency declared. The question has been asked, is it the case that those arriving into Italy simply have the wrong coloured skin for EU authorities? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
In the limelight.
When the term de-dollarization was coined, there was a concrete idea behind it, that the US currency would be uncrowned someday. And when we talk about the US decline, we cannot avoid talking about de-dollarization and the end of dollar hegemony in the world. Believe it or not, the world is going to be multipolar as world economies are exhausted by the US military and financial bullying. So, efforts are underway to topple the dollar. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to the website of People Dispatch, a senior Russian official indicated that a new currency project might be announced at the upcoming BRICS summit in South Africa. The alliance's other members, including Brazil, China, Russia, and India, have already taken steps to bypass the US-dominated global trade and finance system. Speaking recently on the sidelines of the Russian-Indian Strategic Partnership for Development and Growth Business Forum in Indian capital New Delhi, the deputy chairman of Russian State Duma, Alexander Bobakov, announced that BRICS states including Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa were working towards the creation of a new currency. The bloc's members have made key moves away from the US-dominated international trade and financial system. The transition to settlements in national currencies is the first step. The next one is to provide the circulation of digital or any other form of a fundamentally new currency in the near future, Bobakov said. He further claimed that readiness to realize this project will be indicated at the upcoming BRICS summit, be held in August in Durban, South Africa. While further details of this landmark project are yet to be fully revealed, it is already clear that its scope will be significant. The current BRICS countries already account for 40% of the global population and 1/4 of the global GDP. The alliance is now set to expand with Iran and Saudi Arabia, having initiated the formal process to join. Over 10 other countries, including Egypt, Algeria, the UAE, Mexico, Argentina, and Nigeria, have also expressed interest in joining the bloc. Babakov added that the new currency would be based on a strategy that does not defend the dollar or euro and will be pegged to the value of not just gold but also other groups of products, rare earth minerals or soil. The first part of this process, namely trade in national currencies, is already well underway. On March 29th, China and Brazil, the world's second largest economy and Latin America's biggest economy respectively, announced that they will conduct bilateral trades in their local currencies, the Chinese yuan, and bypassing the US dollar. China is Brazil's biggest trade partner, with bilateral trade $150 billion in 2022. China's currency, the renminbi, has also become Brazil's second largest international reserve currency. While the creation of an alternative system to counter dollar dominance, or more broadly, monetary cooperation in the face of U.S. dominance, had been discussed among the BRICS states for years, the blanket sanctions imposed on Russia by the U.S. and its allies gave further impetus for countries to move in this direction. Both Russia and China have reaffirmed their commitment to advancing bilateral trade in their national currencies, and this was reiterated at their joint summit in March. Russian President Vladimir Putin said, "We should continue promoting settlements in national currencies and expand the reciprocal presence of financial and banking structures in our country's markets. At this stage, two-thirds of payments on the trade deals between our countries are made in rubles and yuan." He also highlighted that trade between Russia and China had increased by over 30% in the past year and was expected to reach $200 billion in 2023. Putin also expressed support for the use of the Chinese yuan in transactions between Russia and its partners in Asia, Africa, and Latin America, where China is already the largest trade partner for many of the countries. The growing trend toward seeking alternatives to reduce dollar dependence, including trade in local currencies, is also being deliberated upon by regional organizations, including the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. Earlier this year, Brazil and Argentina also proposed to work towards creating a common currency called SOR to enhance regional trade and financial exchanges while reducing reliance on the US dollar. Not only is the BRICS bloc seeking to move away from de-dollarization in matters of trade and finance, it has also attempted to provide an alternative to the U.S.-dominated Bretton Woods institutions, the International Monetary Fund, IMF, and the World Bank in the form of the New Development Bank, NDB. At present, aside from the five BRICS countries, Egypt, the UAE, and Bangladesh are also members of the NDB. One of the reasons to set up the NDB, South Africa's foreign minister Naledi Pandor told Sputnik, was to seek an alternative to the dollar-based payments architecture. The systems currently in place tend to privilege very wealthy countries and tend to be really a challenge for countries such as ourselves, which have to make payments in dollars, which costs more in terms of various currencies, he said. The website of Mint also noted President Vladimir Putin adopted a new foreign policy identifying China and India as its main allies on the world stage. Now the ties between the three nations and a few others appear poised to go a step further with the formation of a new currency. According to reports quoting Russian lawmaker Alexander Babakov, the BRICS nations are in the process of creating a new medium for payments established on a strategy that does not defend the dollar or euro. He reportedly indicated that the new currency would be secured by gold and other commodities, such as the rare earth elements. While the claim is yet to be verified by other officials from the member nations, it came mere days before South Africa sent senior officials to Russia to discuss recalibration of the global order with President Putin's party. The country is also slated to host a BRICS summit in August this year. Earlier, President Putin adopted a new foreign policy that put India and China at the forefront. The announcement also came mere days after Chinese Premier Xi Jinping visited Moscow to further cement the no-limits partnership announced last year. Russia will continue to build up a particularly privileged strategic partnership with the Republic of India, with a view to enhance and expand cooperation in all areas on a mutually beneficial basis and place a special emphasis on increasing the volume of bilateral trade, strengthening investment and technological ties, and ensuring their resistance to destructive actions of unfriendly states and their alliances, the statement said. It also announced its intention to prioritize and enhance its capacity and international role in groupings such as BRICS to help adapt the world to the realities of a multipolar world.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Spotlight, I'm Prabhat Athwaite. The U.S. is continuing its militaristic approach towards nuclear-armed North Korea. In the latest offensive, U.S. President Joe Biden and his South Korean counterpart said Pyongyang would face the end of its leadership if it uses its nuclear arsenal. Why is the U.S. provoking North Korea, who has been on a rapid pace when it comes to developing nuclear weapons? China has reacted, warning Washington and Seoul against provoking confrontation with North Korea. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at how the U.S. in addition to China, is facing another standoff, namely with North Korea. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the program. Ken Hamon, professor of East Asian and Global History at New Mexico State University, joins us from New Mexico. Also joining us, Harley Schlanger, spokesman at the International Schiller Institute, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany.
This is The Spotlight.
The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both, and I'll first start with you, Ken Hammond, if I may. The President, Joe Biden, couldn't be clearer in terms of what he said. And let me quote him. Look, a nuclear attack by North Korea against the U.S. or its allies or partners is unacceptable and will result in the end of whatever regime to take such an action. It kind of reminds us of the will be met with fire and fury, or whatever that was that the U.S. President, former U.S. President Donald Trump said. Which one do you think is worse? Are they sending the same message?
Well, I think they're definitely sending the same message. It's just a question of the selection of rhetoric. This kind of threat to North Korea. Of course, you know, the only reason that North Korea is investing its resources in its own nuclear program is to defend itself against the threat that the United States has constituted towards it for 50 plus years now, 60 plus years now, since the end of the war on the peninsula. You know, North Korea is in a very defensive position, and these latest actions by President Biden and, as you mentioned, President Trump before him, simply ratchet up the tensions and are part of, you know, America's aggressive stance trying to maintain its position in East Asia.
Yeah, and when you think that the tension is going to be higher, they keep increasing, Harley Schlanger. I mean, basically, Washington and Seoul have secured this deal, which is called the Nuclear Pact, from what we understand, which is a the way it's been described, a periodic deployment of U.S. nuclear submarines to South Korea. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Harley Schlanger, but the U.S. has said that it will not subscribe to having nuclear arms in the peninsula, especially in South Korea. But doesn't this constitute that, be it intermittently?
Well, I don't think you can go by anything that President Biden is saying. I agree with the other guest that what we're seeing is a reckless ratcheting up of tensions coming from Washington. And I would urge the people of South Korea to take a look at what Washington and NATO are doing to Ukraine by bringing the Ukrainians into the war that they're trying to wage against Russia. It's destroying that country. The idea that Biden is preparing for a nuclear response to North Korea. You know, this is at the same time that the Biden administration is accusing Putin of threatening to use nuclear weapons, which Putin is not doing. So you add to this that this represents an extension of NATO to the Pacific, the so-called global NATO, which includes the Australian, UK, US nuclear submarine deal. Now the South Koreans, the Japanese are being brought in, rearming Japan. This is all insane. It's based on a U.S. reaction against the fact that China has become a successful economic nation, and that's why it's being viewed as a threat. And I bring up this question of what's happening to Ukraine because while the U.S. is saying we're doing this for Ukrainian freedom and democracy, what's happening is they're killing off the people of Ukraine for the purposes of a NATO attempt to weaken or break up Russia. So the people of South Korea would be very wise to look at what's happening in Europe on the other side of the globe and realize having a promise from the United States such as this only means there's a likelihood of a war, which will be a catastrophe for the people of South Korea and of North Korea.
Okay, when our guest there, Ken Hammond, talks about how South Koreans should react to this and take a lesson from what's happening to Ukraine, it makes it sound like South Korea perhaps has sovereignty when it comes to its military doctrine. But correct me if I'm wrong, based on some of the research done here, the South Korea, in particular its military, does not really have a say when it comes to the way that it can react in its foreign policy arena unless the U.S. directs it or approves it. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that's exactly correct. The provisions of the relationship between the United States and the military in South Korea are that even in ordinary times, there's a tremendous amount of coordination. A lot of South Korean military personnel are rotated through assignments with American units so that they train together and their functioning is largely integrated. In the event that any kind of hostilities should occur, the command of the South Korean Army reverts to the United States. So in essence, the South Korean Army becomes simply an extension of American military power in the southern part of the peninsula. So the idea that that the South Korean military is in some way, you know, might be a counterbalance or something like that to American recklessness, I'm afraid is not that's not going to work very well. But I do agree that the, you know, the people of South Korea need to be very cautious about what their government is doing, and perhaps rethink the power that they have invested in Mr. Yoon, because he is obviously aligning himself quite closely with American interests, which are not necessarily at all the same as those of the South Korean people.
Yeah, and when you take a look, Harley Steiger, at the U.S., in particular, obviously, Joe Biden, have you detected any statements, any motions, or anything that's even rings any kind of diplomacy when it comes to North Korea? I mean, not even an ounce at this point, going on to almost 4 years now in his presidency. Why do you think he has not even made any effort to pursue down that path, just in statements, maybe not making a commitment, but just invoke some kind of a diplomatic overture to North Korea?
Well, I think that's characteristic of his overall policy. Whatever else Biden is, he is a puppet for the interests that are committed to maintaining the United States as the world hegemon, the unipolar order, what Blinken calls the rules-based order, which means the U.S. determines the rules. And countries like South Korea, Japan, Australia become subordinate to U.S. interests. But the idea is that the U.S. is trying to fight these wars with other people's armies. Now, in that context, when you talk about Biden and diplomacy, where's the diplomacy that could have avoided the war in Ukraine? He rejected it. So did NATO. Now the same thing is going on toward China and North Korea. Say what you will about Donald Trump, but he did try to talk to the North Koreans, and there was a brief moment before he unleashed the lunatic John Bolton. There was a brief moment where there was conversation going on with North Korea. There's none of that we've seen from Biden, including back channels. There was a talk of a back channel, which never, as far as I know, never really was activated.
Well, taking a look at what the South Korean president has said, Ken Hammond, it's interesting. He said, Seoul will respond firmly to North Korean provocations, but will keep the door open for dialogue on North Korean denuclearization. This kind of sounds like it's dictating the way that were there to be any talks, North Korea should behave, which is the same error in the approach that the U.S. has made when it comes to North Korea. Why are they not open to negotiations when we're talking about North Korea's firing of these missiles, which has been ramped up in the past year, especially in the past 6 months?
Well, I think that North Korea's missile tests and whatever other military developments they're pursuing, as we've said before, you know, these are their defensive measures. You know, North Korea is threatened. You know, we have American troops in the southern part of the peninsula, where the ROK troops are there. You know, now the United States is talking about having nuclear submarines with atomic weapons on them, making port calls in South Korea. North Korea has obviously, you know, got to do something to try to keep the United States and its projection there in South Korea from simply trying to get rid of it, trying to destroy it. That's the long-term objective, of course, is to get rid of the North Korean regime, get rid of the North Korean government, get rid of the North Korean state. So I think that you know, when the South Korean president, you know, makes a gesture of sort of saying, well, you know, we'll go along with with the United States, but we also want to, you know, leave the door open for possible talks about denuclearization, and then agrees to having these port calls by American nuclear-armed submarines. You know, the contradiction there, it's just barefaced. I mean, it's just the way that they say one thing and do another thing. We see this in American, you know, political rhetoric and political actions a lot, that there's this verbal commitment to certain principles, and then the government acts in ways that are diametrically opposed to those. So I think that the reluctance to even you know, broach the idea of negotiation of an engagement with the other side just reflects the depth of the anxiety, the depth of the fear that American political elites have of losing their dominant hegemonic position. And I think they fear, you know, I suppose, starting down some slippery slope that's going to result in a further deterioration of their power. But I think that, you know, it's a very dangerous attitude and posture to maintain.
Well, Harley Stanger, you talked about the former U.S. President Donald Trump, and you said whatever you think about him, at least he made an effort to speak to the North Korean leader, and that was a positive sign. But when it came down to it, wasn't there also openness, maybe, when it came to any type of sanction relief for North Korea, which appears to be one of the things that North Korea is not getting from the U.S. I think if we want to take a look at that, that is something that perhaps is an impediment. It's stopping any type of perhaps cooling down of North Korea and being more open towards any diplomatic and negotiated type of settlement for this.
Well, you're absolutely right about that. There's a complete hypocrisy. And I wasn't defending Trump. I was just pointing out that he at least had a discussion process. But you're absolutely right. If you want to have rapprochement with a country, you don't start by sending nuclear submarines in their backyard and talking about the willingness to use nuclear weapons to defend your ally in South Korea. The negotiations start by looking at what's the big problem there. North Korea has an economic crisis. It's had it for a long time because of its isolation. You don't solve that problem by making them more isolated, by rattling sabers at them, and talking about deliberate action to ensure the protection of South Korea, which wouldn't need to be protected if there was a true rapprochement. I think the hypocrisy of the U.S. policy is now seen by virtually everyone. I'm surprised the South Koreans have been blind to it. You know, I'm not so surprised about the Japanese because they have a whole history of this. And the Australians, well, they're part of the Five Eyes. But most of the rest of the world is moving away from this kind of U.S. hegemon, unipolar order idea where the U.S. makes the rules and everyone else has to submit to them or be targeted for military action. So I think what Biden, you know, Trump, whatever he intended to do, he failed. Biden is not even willing to make a gesture. And I think that speaks very poorly for not just Biden, but the people around him, such as Blinken and Sullivan and Victoria Nuland and the old Clinton-Obama crowd like Susan Rice. All of them are part of the Democratic Party War Hawk faction. And that's not a solution to these kinds of problems.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Ken Hammond, let's just say by some miracle, by something that perhaps the U.S. may do, North Korea is willing to think about getting into some kind of negotiations with the U.S. But when it thinks about getting into that diplomatic arena, there's a precedent that has been set here in the Islamic Republic. We're very well aware of what happens when you get into an agreement with the U.S. on a nuclear-related issue. All they have to do is take a look at that and say, why should we get into an agreement with the U.S. when this is what they have done? Doesn't that serve as a warning sign for North Korea, were there to ever be a channel opened up that way?
Well, I think the North Koreans have their own experience with that as well. Back in the second Bush administration, there were actually some overtures. North Korea stepped away from some of its research, some of its nuclear development, and there was a program to sort of move forward with negotiations and with providing assistance to for energy development and things like that. And the United States subsequently completely abrogated that, walked away from that, just dropped it like a hot rock. And so I don't know why the North Koreans, would have a lot of faith or trust in American diplomacy. It's been shown to be hypocritical, not just in the relationship with North Korea, but many times in the past. So, the dilemma, of course, is that North Korea would like to be able to, devote its resources to its own economic development, to improving the livelihoods of its people. But it is under constant, relentless pressure and threat from the South, from the United States, which requires it to maintain this military development. And, it's as a long-term strategy, of course, we've seen the United States use arms races in the past to wreak havoc with the Soviet Union. So this idea of kind of just keeping the pressure on relentlessly and constantly provoking the North, it's designed eventually to bring about some kind of breakdown or some sort of systemic change. So I think that North Korea is entirely reasonable in learning from their experience and learning from the experience, as you mentioned, of the nuclear discussions with the Islamic Republic. And the United States just does nothing but pursue its own self-interest or the self-interest of its ruling classes. And, North Korea has to make the best path that it can in navigating that situation.
All right, let's talk about China a little bit here, Harley Schlanger. And first of all, China has said all parties should face up to the crux of the Korean Peninsula issue and play a constructive role in promoting peaceful settlement of the issue. What's very interesting about China in terms of what the U.S. Has said regarding North Korea and also what the U.S. has asked Russia is that it has said both Russia and China should play a role in using their influence on North Korea for it to stop firing these projectiles. Why would China even entertain that thought when the U.S. is after China offensively, militarily? And I'm not going to say, of course, how the U.S. has been after Russia and the way that Russia has responded to this and China.
Well, the Russians and the Chinese know something about the intention of the ruling establishment in the United States. It's not to establish zones of peace and economic development. Everywhere the United States goes, as at the same with the situation before that with the British Empire, people are left impoverished. The idea of the United States is not to have economic development in these countries. If we wanted to, we could do that. And you're absolutely right, starting with ending the sanctions. Sanctions, in my opinion, are war crimes, because the more people have been killed in some of these countries like Iraq by sanctions than by the actual war. And on this point you were making about the Islamic Republic and the U.S. treatment of Iran, look at Libya. Libya also ended their weapons of mass destruction program, and look what the U.S. did to Gaddafi. So there's no reason for North Korea to have trust and confidence in the United States. And now we're hearing the same thing from Putin. What Putin has said is there's no one to work with in the West. There's no one we can trust because of the level of betrayal. But that's the question of intent. And I think it's really important to understand that the leaders of the United States and both parties, the leaders of most of the political or the governments in Europe, have an intent to maintain the limited sovereignty of nations outside of their own circle. And that's something which is changing now. Countries are demanding the right to have economic development, an end to the colonial and neo-colonial system. And the U.S. just keeps doubling down on insisting that we in the United States can make the rules and everyone else has to obey, or we have NATO or global NATO to enforce those rules. And that's not a winning proposition.
Curious to know whether the countries in that region, Ken Hammond, are on board when it comes to what the U.S., Japan, and South Korea, for example, are doing when it comes to North Korea. I mean, surely these countries can't, don't want any type of military confrontation to happen here, especially when you're talking about a nuclear one, potentially. I'm sure they're not all on board when it comes to the U.S. move towards North Korea. Or are they? Or how do you feel the situation is like there?
Well, I think you know, there's a range of variation across the region. Some of the governments, and we have to be clear, these are decisions that are being made by governments in power in different countries. Some of the governments, Japan and at the present time South Korea, are aligning themselves closely with the United States. There have been large demonstrations in South Korea, also some demonstrations in Japan, expressions of protest against that alignment, against these new policies, against the rearmament in Japan. I'm sure that there will be concern expressed by many people in South Korea about these nuclear-armed submarine visits that are on the agenda now. I think if you look elsewhere around the region, you can see countries that are very anxious about the American role. Even a country like the Philippines, where you know they're having base agreements with the United States again. But there's considerable unease about American conduct. And when you get down certainly into Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand even, Malaysia, Indonesia, these countries are very cautious in their attitude towards the United States. They don't want to totally alienate the United States. They don't want the United States to start seeing them as enemies, because that's a very dangerous proposition. But they're very clearly expressing their desire to find, you know, maybe a middle path, a way not to be aligned so closely with the United States, because they recognize that really the future in East Asia, Southeast Asia, and much of the world is the future.